Case number 13-3066, United States of America v. Paul David Height, Appellant. Mr. Robbins for the Appellant, Ms. Heffernan for the Appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Larry Robbins for Appellant, Dr. Height. In the time available this morning, subject, of course, to this Court's questions, I want to make two basic points. First, Dr. Height's conduct did not violate Section 2422B as appropriately construed. But second, if the statute is truly as broad as the government contends, that is all the more reason, especially given the draconian levels of punishment associated with the statute, to insist on a level playing field at trial. And because of both instructional errors and evidentiary errors, this was anything but a level playing field at trial. I'd like to start with the two statutory arguments, if I might. Dr. Height's conduct fell outside the ambit of 2422B in two independent respects. The first, as we argue in our brief, is that he communicated only with someone who was and whom he knew to be an adult, especially if the rule of lenity is taken seriously. The verb clause in Section 2422B requires direct communication with the minor. It's true that the verb clause can take indirect meaning, but in a situation in which either meaning is possible, we suggest that the rule of lenity requires the tie to go to the defendant, especially in light of a legislative history that is surpassingly clear. There was a paradigm, a specific problem that Congress had in mind, making the Internet a safe space for children. That is the paradigm Congress had in mind.
So let me be clear. In the instructions to the jury, then, are the provisions or the sentences that you're objecting to, do you have your record before you?
I have the record. I do have your
Well, it's where the judge instructs, quote, the government must only prove that the defendant believed he was communicating with someone who could arrange for the child to engage in unlawful sexual activity, close quote, and the sentence that or intended to persuade an adult to cause a minor.
Yes.
Now, well, the government says, just in response to that and this argument, that you have to look at those instructions in their entirety, and the judge had indicated to the jury that there were these elements, and now she was discussing each of these elements. And so when you look at the entirety of the instructions, you see that indeed the instructions are consistent with your interpretation of the statute.
Well, let me distinguish Judge Rogers' two different arguments. Our principal argument is not an instructional argument.
No, I understand.
It's a sufficiency argument. We contend that if 2422B is correctly construed, the evidence simply doesn't fit under that statute. I think what Your Honor is referring to is our instructional argument. And let me address that.
Well, what I'm focusing on is what the jury was instructed law was.
Well, what this jury was told explicitly is exactly what Judge Brown found to be wrong in the Lorraine's case in which she dissented. It's the precise same instruction. And it says this, Judge Rogers. It says, all the defendant needs to do is to persuade an adult. And the adult need not persuade the child. And there need not be even an intent to persuade the child. All the intent needs to be is that the adult cause or arrange for a sexual relationship.
Okay, just backing up, Mr. Robbins, and from the jury instruction and looking at the statutory argument, the indictment, why should we not understand coerce or the other verbs in the statute to include the concept of compelling by way of the other adult as the instrument? And many of the cases, as you know, have accepted, affirmed convictions under this statute where one adult coerces or entices or persuades through the medium of another adult.
Yes.
And in fact, that's quite common with pre-verbal children who are not independently on the Internet, that if a defendant communicates, persuades, entices through the child's parent, through another adult in charge. That seems like a natural reading of the statute, that should suffice.
I think it's a permissible reading. I hope we've been sufficiently clear in our briefing and in the 28J letter we submitted. I recognize that other circuits, a number of them, have held that the statute can, Judge Pillard, be violated through an adult intermediary. But that is just the beginning of the problem for the government. Let's grant, for argument's sake, that those circuits are correct and that you can, in fact, persuade, induce, entice, and coerce through an adult intermediary. That's just the beginning of the problem. There is then the following question. Did the defendant intend the adult intermediary to persuade, and not just persuade in the abstract, persuade in the way the statute says you must persuade, persuade through the use of interstate means, which brings me to the second independently sufficient problem with this prosecution. The statute, like the Supreme Court's Bailey case, in which the Supreme Court held unanimously that the word use means active use, the word use and the interstate means element here modifies the verb clause, which means, even if you accept, Judge Pillard, the proposition that this statute can be violated through the use of an adult intermediary, even if you accept that, you must take the further, I would submit, a textual step to uphold this conviction, because there is no evidence, zero evidence, that the defendant intended that the act of persuasion be done through interstate means.
The statute reads, using the mail or any facility or means of interstate or foreign commerce or within the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States. Why shouldn't we just read that as a post-Lopez jurisdictional hook, that there has to be some use of the Internet, this is a federal law? And, I mean, how would you read this special maritime and territorial jurisdiction if the statute means what you think it means, if it's
well,
that narrow?
I am not sure the best understanding of the special maritime jurisdiction. I would submit that the natural reading is that both of those modify the verb clauses. So, but to be clear, it does seem to me that the word use in this statute and the way it's been understood in other statutes modifies the way in which you must persuade. You must persuade through the use of the Internet. For example, suppose this were not an intent case, an attempt case, and it was, in fact, the completed act. I think nobody would contend that it would be sufficient to persuade without doing so over a telephone or through the Internet or through some interstate means. That's the same thing I would contend if it were simply as an attempt case alone. But let me, because I know...
Mr. Robbins,
yes, Judge.
The government says on their brief at page 4, and I checked the record, and in their brief seems to accurately describe the record, that the defendant suggested a picture on an Internet profile to be shown to the complaining witness to see if she would like it.
Yes.
And that he also said to Detective Palchak, who he thought was just an adult, not a cop, to ask her if she would agree. Palchak said to him that he would ask her if she would agree to engage in a sexual act with him. And the defendant responded, "Sounds like a plan." So, in at least those two instances, wasn't there evidence from which a reasonable jury could say that he either suggested or agreed over the Internet to an act that could be construed as persuasion, enticement, etc.?
There is no question, Judge Wilkins, that we are not contending that we are not contending that there is nothing that could possibly be read to constitute an act of persuasion. What I'm suggesting is there is no evidence that the act of persuasion that was intended was an act of persuasion in the way that the statute requires, which is an act of persuasion through the Internet, that the persuasive act, the act of persuading the child itself, in this case, obviously a fictitious child, must be done through interstate means. But
Judge Wilkins, one of the two pieces of evidence that he talked about, which is a picture that is available on the Internet, presumably if Mr. Palchik showed that to the child, that would be relayed over the Internet. So both you have both links of the chain, Mr. Haidt speaking to Mr. Palchik, happening over the Internet, Mr. Palchik showing the picture to the child, happening over the Internet.
Well, the latter part, Judge Pillard, I think there is not evidence
It's Pillard.
Pillard, I apologize. Judge Pillard, I do not think that the record is clear, Your Honor, how Palchik was supposed to convey it. But I see that my time is dwindling, and we've spent a lot of time, I've spent a lot of time on the statutory issues. If I'm wrong about that, I think it requires all the more that the playing field at the trial be level. And we've explained in three independent respects how the playing field was not level. Because I have limited time this morning, I want to turn, if I can.
Do you want to rely on your brief?
Well, I do want to rely on my brief, but I want to just emphasize with respect to the striking of all respect, in all respects of the government's, of the defense expert, I really submit respectfully that even under an abuse of discretion standard, that decision cannot be justified. And what I think is most troubling, particularly given the nature of the defense, given the harshness of the penalties, given the fact that this defendant sits in jail for 22 years, the fact that he could not put on the foremost expert in the country, a man who's been a doctor who's been whose testimony on these exact issues has been admitted for the exact same purposes on the exact same Rule 16 notice in two substantially similar cases by both Judge Bates and Judge Boasberg, I submit cannot be defended. And even therefore, if you think I'm wrong about the statutory arguments I've made this morning, the fact that he couldn't put on the doctor to rebut the pornography evidence that the government was able to put in on the very same premise that the defense sought to rebut it, the fact that he couldn't put in a diagnosis, the fact that he couldn't explain the difference between fact and fantasy.
Putting aside the more general aspects of the expert testimony, what about the aspect of his proposed testimony, the expert Berlin's testimony, that reached the conclusion that the specific chats and evidence in this case between the defendant and the undercover do not appear to be reflective of any interest in actually being sexual with a child? To me, that seems to state an opinion about whether he had the mental state that's at issue in this case, and the judge, in the exercise of her discretion, excluded that.
Yeah, Judge Pillard, I accept that that aspect of the issue is a close call. But the answer to Your Honor's question is this. Rule 703 says on its face, and this Court's decision in Smith says on its face, that the predicates for an expert's opinion need not be independently admissible for the opinion itself to be admissible. And so even if you believe...
But on the ultimate question, the jury is to decide?
Well, if the predicate for his opinion is in fact something the jury needs to decide, and I, for various reasons, do not think that's the case here, he may still consider it if it's something which experts in his field consider. If, for example, as Judge Bates and Judge Boasberg both concluded, it is permissible in a case like this to offer evidence of a diagnosis, surely a competent psychiatrist, much less the world-renowned psychiatrist the defense wanted to call, would look at the chats and examine them and interpret them. And it may well be, Judge Rogers and Judge Pillard, that in the end he could not say, I have interpreted the chats to mean X. That I am prepared to accept, for argument's sake, could arguably invade the jury's province on the ultimate issue. But 703 tells us that his opinion is nevertheless admissible, as two other judges on the exact same set of facts with the exact same Rule 16 notice accepted. My time is running out. Right. I'd like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal if I could.
All right. We'll
thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, Patricia Heffernan on behalf of the United States. Starting with the substance of the statutory challenge that appellant argued, specifically the interstate means hook. The appellant here was charged with an attempt. And so the statute outlaws using interstate means or to persuade or, as Your Honor pointed out, persuasion in the special maritime territorial jurisdiction of the United States. All that the statute with respect, at the very least with respect to attempt, required was that the defendant use the internet or interstate means in an attempt to persuade. And that's exactly what he did here when he spent 2 weeks arranging to arranging a meeting for purposes of engaging in sexual activity with a 12-year-old and a 3-year-old.
So how far does that go? The argument is he was persuading the adult to do certain things, but not the children.
Yeah, he was persuading, we think in this case there's enough to show that that not only does this case fit within the five circuits that said that persuading the adult is enough, but that he, more along the lines of McMillan and Spurlock, he intended that he asked that communications be passed along to the children, to the 12-year-old girl.
Now, what about those communications? He asked, which are the communications that he asked to be passed along?
He discussed with Palachek finding out what the girl thought, and then...
Which is having her communication passed along to him, but in terms of his communication being passed along...
Well, the initial communication was, what's your interest in participating in sex with this third person? So that would be a communication that would be passed to the 12-year-old girl. The arrangement that they had
and the
made.
The persuading or inducing or enticing or coercing in that communication is what?
Well, the government's view, that takes me one step back.
To be clear, I'm trying to focus on what might have been the substantial step here.
There were several substantial steps. All of these different email communications arranging the use of the internet to arrange the sexual encounter with the 3-year-old and the 12-year-old, and there are also specific communications where he agrees that Palachek ought to ask the girl what she thinks about the idea, to show the girl the picture, to say hello to the girl for her, and with respect to the boy.
So just to be very, very specific, if we were to follow the circuits that read the statute broadly enough to encompass conduct by the defendant using the undercover as an intermediary to communicate to the child, what are the communications in this case through Palachek? If you could be just as specific as you could about what those are and how they might constitute a substantial step.
The communications with respect to the girl, with respect to the 12-year-old, would be the initial suggestion of sex with Palachek, the going to the girl to find out what she thinks about
persuade, entice, that's what we're looking for.
Well, in the government's view, the discussion about having sex, whether or not the girl would be interested in having sex with Palachek, is sufficient to persuade, induce, entice, or coerce.
Palachek is inviting Height to, he says, I have these children over whom I have control. Are you interested? What I'm trying to get at is your best evidence of Height persuading, not accepting an offer, but saying, look, be my emissary here, you know, set this up, get her ready, get her.
And
there's a picture, so he's agrees to Pelchuk's suggestion, you know, send my picture, anything else?
Send my picture, and the initial, would you be interested in this? I mean, that's exactly the kind of communications that these other circuits have found.
We're not bound by them, all right?
That's right.
And we do have a dissenting opinion in this circuit that obviously we are aware of. And so we're trying to hone in here, as Judge Pillard is asking you to help us do, on the substantial step by the defendant.
Okay. And the substantial step is the
so we have the photograph.
We have the photographs. We have the say hello to her for me. This notion that he's getting, asking the intermediary to get the girl familiar with him. I mean, that's obviously a step towards persuading her to engage in the sex that they're discussing. With respect to the boy, you have he's asking Pelchuk to give the boy Benadryl so that his...
Pelchuk is raising that idea.
Right.
And the defendant says, you know, I'm not sure how he directly responds to that. Maybe you could fill us in on that.
The defendant himself brings up the Benadryl at other points and says, we need to make sure we have Benadryl with the boy. And so that would be the coercion, at the very least, aspect of making sure that the child is sufficiently sedated so he doesn't recall. You know, there's all this discussion about, well, aren't we worried that he's going to emulate this at home or repeat things at home? And so so there's the need for Benadryl so that the child won't do that, so that he talks about blurring the child's recollection of what happened.
I need to understand what the government's position is with respect to what act is required to sustain a conviction. Does the government agree with the proposition, I guess most recently from the Seventh Circuit, that the defendant, if he uses an intermediary, the intermediary must take an act that persuades the child? Do you agree that's the proper construction of at least the act that has to happen? Not just that there is an act to persuade the intermediary, but that the defendant intend for the intermediary to use an act that persuades the child.
We think
or
that the
entices, you know.
We think that the proper construction of the statute is simply the communications. All that's required are the communications between the two adults, and it's the defendant, and that the defendant used a means of interstate commerce in an attempt to achieve the persuasion, and I think
the persuasion of the other adult.
The other adult, yes.
So you're taking
that's enough.
Taking the broadest view of the statute, and then in terms of substantial act, you're saying the minimum required there is
the communications that he engaged in over the internet, arranging for the sexual encounter. And we've got 2 weeks of communications arranging for the sexual encounter.
So that's if you had these 2 weeks of communications and what the undercover had said was, I have an underage child coming to visit me a year from now in the summer, and let's plan about that. That would be a substantial step, having those conversations to plan that at that time the men would encounter the child.
That's a more difficult situation because you're talking about a year out, as opposed to in this case and all the other cases, which involve, which were, you know, immediate situations where the encounter was to take place right away.
Assume, just for purposes of the argument, that we were to adopt the slightly narrower construction where you would have to the defendant, in order to fall within the statute, would have to persuade the child through the adult, use the other adult as a messenger. In that case, what do you think is the evidence in this case that was before the jury that would support a conviction as a substantial step?
If I'm understanding Your Honor's question, I think it really gets back to the discussion we had before, which is taking, with respect to the girl, taking this suggestion to the girl to see what she thinks of it, and would she do that, would she engage in that, showing the girl the picture with respect to the three-year-old boy, asking the intermediary to make sure that there's Benadryl on hand to so that the boy doesn't recall what goes on. But it brings us to our broader argument, which is, we think that Congress intended to cover the field of communications.
That's an interesting notion, that drugging the victim is persuasion.
It's coercion. It's coercion. Mm-hmm. It nullifies the child's will. But I do want to make the broader point, which is we think Congress meant to cover the field with these verbs. The underlying appellant's argument is a suggestion that there are ways of planning sexual encounters with children that aren't persuasive enough, or that, you know, don't bamboozle the child enough, or, you know, that there's a bunch of legitimate ways of arranging sexual encounters with children that are not prescribed by the statute. We disagree with that.
But and I the think statute the fact says either persuade, entice, coerce the minor, right?
Yes.
So how is it consistent with a plain reading of the statute to say that you don't have to prove that there was ever any persuasion or enticement of the minor, either by the defendant himself or by the intermediary?
Because a minor can't consent or assent. If you have a perfect, let's say we've
the
got a case.
The Congress said, define the crime as you have to persuade the minor. So we just ignore what Congress said?
Well, we think that, and no. But we think that given the fact that you're dealing with a minor, if you're making arrangements to have sex with a minor, you have necessarily persuaded, induced, enticed, or coerced the minor.
That's the sufficiency of the evidence argument. I'm talking about how do you define. Well, let me just ask you this question. If we agree that the Seventh Circuit test in McMillan is the right construction of the statute, that there has to actually be persuasion, enticement, et cetera, of the minor by the intermediary. Where in these jury instructions is that made clear? So that we could conclude that if that's our construction, that this jury was instructed properly.
The jury was instructed that that the cause the minor to engage in, and as the district court explained, that was an umbrella term that would encompass those various terms. I mean, at bottom, the argument seems to be that the defendant needs to.
The jury wasn't told that, right?
Well, the jury was told that.
They weren't told what cause meant, or that cause meant persuade, entice.
The court didn't take the extra step of saying cause encompasses those four terms.
So why shouldn't we conclude that if that's the proper construction of the statute, the Seventh Circuit, that this jury wasn't properly instructed, that there was at least confusion as to that element, and the key issue of the case can't be harmless?
Well, I think the court could find that it was harmless because no jury properly instructed would not have found that, given the communications that he asked to be passed along to the girl, find out what she thinks about it, asking what she thought about it, passing the picture to the girl, and the communications with respect to the three-year-old boy, the need for the intermediary to get Benadryl to drug the child, which would be the coercion act.
I know your time is short, but could I just ask you how you could reconcile on the evidentiary issues the admission of the thumbnails of the child pornography and the exclusion of the expert testimony, as they seem to go to very similar issues in the case?
The defense wanted to call Dr. Berlin to opine that at the end of the day, I think what they were trying to have him opine was, if this meeting had taken place, he wouldn't have gone through with sex with the child. He did not have intent to have sex with this child. But that wasn't the question for the jury, and that's not an element of the offense. The child pornography.
I think the defendants are characterizing it a little more broadly, that the expert is making a distinction between psychiatric conditions of people who are interested in fantasizing about sex with children and people who are interested in having sex with children. And I gather that there are some professionally rigorous criteria for making those kinds of distinctions. And that testimony would go to, I believe the defense is saying, motivation for someone to actually try to entice a child rather than talk dirty to another adult over the phone about acts with children.
The child pornography was evidence of the defendant's sexual interest in children, and that was probative of the defendant's intent to entice these children, particularly with respect to the boy and the webcams. The Palachuk offered to have oral sex with the 3-year-old boy over the webcam.
So then why wasn't the expert testimony that he didn't have actual interest in having sex with children just as admissible?
Well, I think there was a distinction between interest in sexual activity with children and an intent to have sex with children. And other courts have explained the difference. I think it's Bailey that was the first case that talked about that. Those are two very different things. They're two different things, and the intent to have sex with a child is not an element of the offense. So
an expert opinion that he's not a pedophile wouldn't be the direct counter to the reason for introducing the thumb cache?
No, because the he's not a pedophile goes to his intent to have sex with a child. It's a straw man. It's an intent to entice. It's beyond the intent to entice. It's the intent to commit the underlying sex act.
And the intent to entice would be on the path to that act, and if somebody wants to get to the ultimate destination, doesn't that bear on whether they're likely to follow that path to get to that destination?
But the inverse isn't true. And that's what they wanted to argue, that an intent, if you don't have an intent to have sex, you don't have an intent to entice. And that's the inverse is not right. I agree that an intent to entice is on the path to an intent to have sex, but the inverse isn't. And that is so confusing for the jury, and it was not an abuse of discretion to preclude that testimony.
All right. Thank you.
No further questions, we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Counsel for appellant?
Thank you. Let me dispel a red herring right off the bat. The Berlin testimony with respect to the pornography evidence was kept out because the district judge thought the Rule 16 notice did not explicitly tie his testimony to an interest in sex with children as opposed to actual sexual contact. That's the argument the government just made. That is demonstrably false. The top paragraph on page 5 of the notice said in exactly those words that Dr. Berlin was going to testify that having a small amount of pornography in the thumb catch of your computer is not necessarily associated with an interest or desire, those are the magic words the judge thought were missing, in having sex with children. So that is entirely a red herring. Second, Judge Wilkins, I'd like to go back to a line of questions you asked. You asked the government, do you accept the proposition that if this court adopts the approach of the Seventh Circuit in McMillan, whether the instructions were sufficient? And the answer you got was that the word cause, and I would submit the word arrange, are, quote, umbrella terms. I take that to mean that it covers not just the act that the Seventh Circuit said was required, but also other conduct. Conduct that constitutes, in my view, bypassing assent, such as drugging and intoxicating. And there was evidence that Palachuk proposed things like using Benadryl, the purpose of which, I would submit, was to bypass assent.
To coerce.
Well, it's a type of coercion, I agree, but I suggest...
Coerced by its nature is to overcome and sidestep the will of the victim, is it not?
But it can mean that, Judge Pillard.
Does it ever not mean that?
I think it can mean... I think it often does mean prevailing upon and persuading...
Coerce?
Well, I think it does. I think... But all the courts have said that the verbs taken as a whole, and they have to be read as a whole under the nociter principle, all involve operating on the assent, influencing the assent.
Or overcoming it through coercion.
Yes.
I'm not sure the point you're trying to make.
Well, my point is simply that the words cause and arrange are broader and can encompass acts that go beyond even overcoming assent. They can involve, for example, the use of physical force. They can encompass sexual assault. They can encompass a range of despicable conduct that go beyond what even the Seventh Circuit said was a permissible reading of the words persuade, entice, induce, and coerce. And I think there was sufficient evidence on this record for that not to be harmless. But at the end of the day...
So in your view, if an adult said to a child in his care over the internet or called the child and said, I know you're having troubles with allergies, take your Benadryl, honey, and I'll be home soon, and the adult could be shown to intend that action to coerce the child and ready the child for sex, that would not be covered.
No, I'm not prepared to say that, Judge Pillard. I think that might well be covered. The question in this case is whether on this record an instruction that invited the jury to convict on the basis of causing and arranging for sex was both wrong and prejudicial.
I think they put that under induce.
Well, even so. But look, at the end of the day, I really do want to come back to the question of the level playing field. Because if I'm wrong about the narrowing construction of the statute, and many circuits have said that I'm wrong, so I may well be wrong about that.
Do you have one that agrees with you?
Well, I have one judge on this circuit who agrees with me, albeit in dissent from a case that did, the majority of which didn't reach the question. I do not have a circuit that has adopted the narrowing principles, although, let me be clear, I do think that all the circuits that have adopted the adult intermediary have insisted that the adult intermediary act on the will of the child, a proposition which you just heard the government to reject, and which they reject explicitly on page 32 of their brief. But at the end of the day, I want to come back to the question of the level playing field. Because if I'm wrong about what the statute means, and it truly is as broad as the government says, and as the district court ruled, and as the district court instructed the jury, you've got to give defendants facing these kinds of mandatory minimums a fair shake.
Well, I need to be very clear what you're saying there, because your last argument in your brief raises a very different question. It's one thing to say you're entitled to a level playing field. It's another thing to say the judge abused her discretion. And don't you have to convince us of the latter? It may be you don't get a level playing field for reasons that the district court enunciated, in the sense you're using level
yes.
playing field.
Well, I obviously do not mean, Judge Rogers, that we need to win 50% of the issues.
No, I know.
And it certainly doesn't mean that the judge cannot, within the judge's discretion, rule against us on any number of things. What's different here, I respectfully submit, is that we have almost sort of mirror image rulings that tell you that this case was not appropriately tried.
You mean because two other judges allowed your expert to testify?
No, I
need to understand what you mean, because you have your last argument in saying that if it goes back, you want it sent to another judge. And I thought, well, that's what he means. But now we're into, you have to show that there were abuses of discretion.
Yes, and I would respectfully submit that what makes this an unusual case and why the admittedly extreme remedy of changing judges on remand is appropriate is precisely because you can look at the mirror image rulings. For example, they get to put in the pornography. We can't rebut it with our expert. They get to amend their Rule 16 expert notice not once, not twice, but three times. We don't get to do that at all. They get to elicit lay expert testimony about whether, in fact, he was a fantasist or not. We can't call an actual renowned expert who has studied this to rebut it. They get to call Palchik to give his view of things. We can't cross-examine him with the fact that he has twice testified in this district that when you that traveling, leaving your computer to go to the meeting spot is the place where fantasy comes to an end. It's not, in other words, Judge Rogers, simply that there were a number of errors. There were, and they are, in my view, independently reversible, at least for a new trial. But the reason we asked for what I recognize as the extraordinary relief of remanding to a different judge, the reason we ask for that is because each of these errors has a mirror image ruling for the government that in each and every case tilted the playing field.
Ms. Friends, are you making an argument that the evidence to which the government points as comprising a substantial step is not in fact substantial, or is that that's not a ground on which you're resting your case?
I have not made that argument.
Let me be very clear. What argument have you not made?
I think I have not made the argument that the elements of attempt in the abstract have not been satisfied.
Right.
What I have said is that if the statute is construed as we've asked it to be, the evidence is insufficient in at least two independent respects.
Right. And if we don't accept your construction and we accept the construction that the majority of the circuits to have looked at this except, then you don't get the indictment thrown out. Is that right?
Well,
the communicating through another adult to the child.
I don't think so, Judge Pillard. What the other circuits have said is that I am wrong about the proposition that there cannot be an adult intermediary. What they have not had occasion to address is the further question whether, assuming you can use an adult intermediary to persuade on your behalf, whether that persuasive act between the adult intermediary and the child must be through the use of interstate means. No court, to my knowledge, has addressed that question. And so I would not...
I'm not sure anybody else has argued that.
That's your Bailey argument.
That I think, is our Bailey argument. Nobody's made it. I'd like to think somebody always has to be first. But, look, again, I need to come back to the same point, and Judge Rogers, I'll close with this. The court's been very kind about my time this morning. Mm-hmm. These are severe penalties. They give enormous discretion to prosecutors. They give enormous discretion to police officers who can make up two or three or four fictitious kids and each time tack on 10 more mandatory minimum years. For statutes like that, defendants deserve their day in court, and we didn't get it.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.